Is recording. But we like don't have anything funny yet, so
Maybe we can say something funny later for the
in the middle
people.
of the episode. This is Femme Strong, the podcast by, for, and about women in strength sports. I'm Jess.
I'm Britt.
Welcome to the podcast about strength sports that is not dominated by a male voice. And hello, welcome to episode 6, season 2. And we have our first interview of the season, right?
Yeah, we
haven't done
is this
one
the
yet.
First one? Yeah, it
and
is.
It's a great person to start with. We have the PhysioFix, Dr. Stacey Morris, who shared a ton of insights and knowledge with us in our interview. So that'll be probably like 20 to 30 minutes into the episode. So enjoy.
If you're a skipper, skippers unite.
Yes. Remember that one
hang
time
out
that
for
we
the
got.
Fitness.
Remember that one time that we got a review and the person was like upset because it took so long for us to get to the interview?
Yeah. I was like, okay, well, all right. You can
sorry
skip.
That you
that's okay.
Yeah, don't like hearing about the big lifts in the lifting community. Whatever.
Sorry, I don't like hearing about our very personal experiences. Speaking of, Jess, how's training?
I just came off a deload week. Last week was a very, very, very busy week for me for work. So I decided about a week out that I was going to just deload rather than trying to lift when I was working 12-hour days and not getting any days off. But prior, the week before, I, hit my first PR, I think in a year.
Wow.
And it, you know, it wasn't anything huge, just incline bench. I got a rep PR on 135, which honestly, like a year and a half ago, I was struggling to even hit 135 for one. So,
that's a really impressive incline bench, Jess.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That's a lot of load.
Yeah, it felt good and, just made me feel excited about my overhead and about my flat bench, which I have to now train flat bench because the strongman competition that I just signed up for today, which is a qualifier for World's Strongest Woman, has bench press in it.
What?
And yeah, it's a 135 for reps for the open women. And I have never competed in a strongman competition in my 7 years of doing a strongman that has had a bench press. I know it's happened in the past, but I've never experienced
it. I didn't know that even was like an option, genuinely. I thought that it was just not an option.
Well, the cool thing about strongman is almost everything is an option. The one thing that's not is sumo deadlift.
Ever really?
Yeah, never sumo deadlift. I think I don't know where that rule came from, and I'm not really interested in getting into the nitty gritty of that. But yeah, so bench press. This is a contest in August. That's a qualifier for World's Strongest Woman. And I signed up today, which is pretty far ahead of time for me. But I just wanted to get it out of the way. Also, one of the reasons, if I'm being frank, that I wouldn't sign up so far out in the past was because I couldn't afford it. I would have to budget very wisely. And now I have more income, so I can sign up and pay the entry fee. And it's in Tacoma, Washington, which is fairly close to Portland, so I don't have to like get overnight lodging or anything like that. But yeah, so we have bench press, and then chain deadlift. So for the open women, it's 365 on the bottom and 440 on top. And we do that for reps. And I'm pretty stoked about that one too, because I've just been reworking my deadlift form for about 6 months now, maybe a little bit longer than that. And, so I'm, you know, as someone who's deadlifted 500 pounds in the past, I'm just not back to that point. And everyone in my weight class is like hitting 600. So 500 is like for reps for them. So it feels really good that this is like within my current, deadlift reset range. And then we have farmers carry, I'm missing one. This is gonna bother me. Whatever. Oh, sandbag the shoulder. Okay. And then Conan's wheel, which is like a Zercher carry, but in a circle. And then you do one full rotation, and then you have to run and grab a keg and run and load it over the bar, and then grab another keg and do the same thing. So that's my contest. Huh. And so today I got back into it after my deload and benched and felt good and have been working on my bench form. I used to close grip everything, and now I'm learning to not close grip. So yeah. How about you, Britt? Yeah.
Well, let me know if you want or need any help on the bench.
Yes, thank you. I'll definitely be reaching out.
But yeah, I just came off of my meet weekend. So I competed at the time of release just over a week ago at the APF Women's Pro, and had a fucking blast, dude. It was the best meet I've had in a while. Not even so much about the numbers, like I didn't PR deadlift, but it was just like a blast. And a really good friend of mine surprised me by showing up.
That was awesome. That was so cool. Yeah,
shout out to Aaron. You rock my world. You are so nice. And it was really fabulous. And I met a lot of really strong, like, you know, dope lady lifters. And yeah, what was interesting, and I like shared this post to my story, is I have competed raw my entire career, right? And then last year for the Kern, I did wraps. And then this year at this meet, I chose to do raw. And it actually didn't even really have a raw category. I had to like compete with folks in wraps. But I decided to do it just because I'm like training at home and stuff. Anyway, this is not the point. My recovery time was so much quicker than it has been ever before. Like ever, ever, ever. Even just not comparing it directly to the Kern. Because the Kern, I had vacation immediately thereafter. And thank God I did, because I couldn't have like pushed it in the gym the next day even if I wanted to. Whereas this meet, I got home on Monday, like a full day of traveling, got home Monday night, went to work on Tuesday morning, and then was at the gym Tuesday evening before we went to that concert. So, and I was just like ready to like we're explicit, right? I was ready to like fuck shit up. I had to like hold myself back. And I was like, this is crazy. It's like my nervous system adapted to a wrapped meat, and now like a raw meat is like super easy to recover from. So yeah, it was really interesting, but yeah, I really liked it. And now I'm 14 or 15 weeks out from the American Pro. So yeah, on to another.
Did you want to talk through how the meat went for you, or were you planning on doing that later in the
Well, yeah, I kind of touched on it. I just, so I squatted a PR, a sleeve PR of 455 pounds.
Nice.
Which I was pretty excited about because I failed 405 just a little over a week out.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did retake that 405 and, you know, did it because I knew I needed the mental win. So I, you know, got the with the help of my partner, got like the weights back on the bar and took 405 again. And it was still like a like rough. It still wasn't as easy as it should have been, but I did it. So I didn't share that part in my reel, but, and then so PR'd squat by 35 pounds and then bench. I also was getting very frustrated. I was consistently like failing or not progressing, like all the way up to about a month out, to the point where we like removed a bench day, because I was just like, I haven't experienced that type of fatigue before. Usually my tendons give out first, and I wasn't dealing with tendonitis this prep. So that was pretty frustrating. I cried one night a lot. My partner was there. It was really great. And so I went into this fully expecting, I have hit 240 pounds in meets like for years now, and just kind of stuck at like the 245 number. And so I was like, okay, whatever. I'm just going to go in this meet and probably hit 240 again and just whatever. It doesn't matter. Just have fun. And I opened with 220 and it moved like 220 always does. It was like pretty easy. Then I moved up to 235. And I was like, that might have been a little bit of a, like, too much of a leap. Like, this is probably gonna be a little rough. It flew. And then I was like, yo, like, just screw it. Like, let's try for a PR. And 250 looked easier than the 220. So I finally cracked 250, which was really exciting. I think it was like a big mental number for me. Yeah. And then for deadlift, my lifetime PR was more than what I hit like at all, but my second I took 440 and it was like a pretty solid lockout, like pretty easy. So we were just going to go up 15 pounds, but then we realized that the other person in my weight class, who was first, if she missed her third deadlift, and I was going with the weight that I was going to be taking as my third, she would beat me by 5 pounds. But if I went up by 5 pounds and she, you know, scratched her third or didn't complete her third, we would be tied on our total. And I weighed in 0.4 pounds less than her. So that's why we took it. Cause I was like, you know, screw it. Like, it's not a PR anyway. Like, it's not like I'm going up 5 pounds past a PR. Like, none of this, I'm not going to hit a PR today. So screw it. Let's do it. Send it. And I love that part of powerlifting, like the strategy part. So I fucking loved that. I was like all smiles when I realized that it could happen. And, I ended up getting called on hitching. And it was a fair call. I was a little frustrated by it at first, but like, honestly, I'd rather be called on that stuff than not. Like, I don't want to be gifted anything. Right. And yeah. She ended up, the other person ended up scratching her third after I failed, or after I got called, after I got red lighted on the sides. And I was like, oh, fucking sick. We were both playing that game. Like,
yeah,
you were watching me and I was watching you. Like, that's cool. Like, this was two way, you know? So yeah, it was a blast. It was really fun. I love the strategy side of it. And that happens so rarely. And so the fact that got to happen at a meet like that was just like really phenomenal. So
yeah, that's super fun. So you talked about how like overall your recovery was better in sleeves as opposed to wraps, but do you think that because you squatted in sleeves instead of wraps, it affected your deadlift more?
So I would say that I was absolutely shocked at the curve last year when I did wraps. By the time I got to deadlifts, I was gone. Like my energy was completely depleted. My nervous system was in shock because that's not technically true, but I was fried because, I, throughout prep, I had gotten wrapped by other people a couple of times, but not to the degree of severity that it was. Like, my coach was like lighting me up with a really tight wrap. And as you know, that takes a lot of energy out of you. And so I felt like at the Kern last year, I was expecting a huge deadlift and it like just did not happen. I couldn't even break the floor with weights that I've hit like a lot of times. And at that time I had hit for reps. So I was like, oh no. But this time I just, deadlift just wasn't progressing the way that I think we expected it to. And that's okay. Also, my body composition has changed a bit. Like, I've gained weight. And so like, I literally had to not really relearn because I never stopped lifting, but like I had to reevaluate what was most effective for how my body composition has changed. So I'm pretty excited because I plan to do a little baby cut for my next meet. That I'm already like, well into, just kind of exciting. But I, So it'll be cool to see how that like affects and changes my form and like makes lockout easier and stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, I've been through that too. And yeah, anytime you gain or lose weight, it affects your lifts more than I think I would ever anticipate. So yeah.
100%. Yeah. Well, sorry for talking. Actually, I'm not sorry. It's a podcast. No, yeah. You're welcome.
We literally, yeah.
Well, should we move on to our big lifts?
Yes, let's do it.
Cool. Do you want to start with yours?
Sure. I just have one. Britt has four, I believe. So Rachel Baxter, who trains out of the Pro Raw gym in Australia, is prepping for their big meet, which is called the Pro Raw. That makes sense. And she, I believe, is an 80 kilo lifter, and she just hit 230 kilos for her last deadlift single before competition, which is, I literally did the math and forgot to write it down. It's 551 pounds. So as a 82 kilo lifter, that's really,
that's
an impressive number, and that's like in training. So excited to see what she does.
Well, and a lot of people, I mean, it differs a lot from person to person, but like a lot of people peak their deadlifts really well and they don't hit PRs during their preps. So maybe she's one of those.
Yes. Yeah. I guess we'll see.
We will see. Okay. Yeah. So I'll start with, and these are so not in order of when these occurred in the timeline. I've just been saving them as I see them. So the first one is Riley. She is a powerlifting coach. Actually, my powerlifting coach now.
I didn't know you went through with that. Awesome.
Yes, I did. This was before, so this is. her deadlift has been like progressing phenomenally. She is a lower weight class lifter. She has it posted. Let's see. She has competed 67.5, 75, and 82.5. I think now she's more in the middle of there. But regardless, she just deadlifted 468 for a triple.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a lot. Next up, we actually got this submitted by the aforementioned friend. There is an 8-year-old weightlifter and I believe gymnast as well, who I think we may have mentioned on this podcast before, but her name is Rory Van Ulft, I believe is how you say it. She is a 30 kilogram youth national champion. And
I said cute.
Yeah, super cute. And she ended up snatching 36 kilogram, which is 1.25 times her body weight and 9 kilograms above the previous American record. So way to go. Wow. It's exciting to see how early people are starting now, or I mean, specifically young women, girls are starting to compete and, you know, get familiar with barbells.
I mean, imagine breaking a record at 8 years old. Crazy.
You know, I'm just going to say it, like, being like a formerly gifted and talented kid, as I'm sure you were as well, I do worry a little bit about setting those expectations for yourself throughout life. And I just hope that her family is like encouraging of her being valuable as a human being, regardless of her records and stuff like that. Not to say my parents were not, but I think that I think psychology's come a long way and people have like come to understand the potential impacts from that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think I heard somewhere that a lot of public schools are getting rid of their gifted and talented programs. And this is an academic thing. Gifted and talented doesn't apply to like sports, but I was a GAT student from like second grade on. And when you finally get to a point where school is hard, whatever level of education it may be, for me, it was grad school. It's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. It's so hard. I failed my first class my senior year of grad school, 4-year grad program. So I was 25. First time I'd failed anything.
Shocking, I had the benefit. Right?
I know, it just, it rocks you. And I think the benefit that I had is I wasn't good at sports until towards the end of high school. And so like, I was used to like not being the best at things. And so like, as far as athletics go, like that has really served me. I tend to have a chip on my shoulder about that. And so I was able to kind of like apply that to academics. But yeah, it's a lot to go through.
I went through the same thing, but my freshman, like first day of college, because I went to engineering school and everybody there was like the valedictorian of their college. And I was very friggin' far from that. I was like, you know, a well-rounded kiddo. I did athletics. I did academics. Like I did a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's why they took me in, also my ACT score. Like I would not have gotten in with just my GPA. I had a trash, not trash, but not great high school GPA. Anyway, first day I show up and I'm like, I am the bee's knees, it's legs and it's arms. And these kids are like telling me about these like achievements that they've had and how they've like discovered new theories as 12-year-olds. And I was like, oh shit.
Oh,
yes. Oh, no. And then I got really used to being the dumbest person in the room. And I prefer those rooms. So, but okay. So almost done here. I have two more. So next up, we have Amanda Fiatoa. It's been a little bit since we've talked about her. I think that she just took a little bit of a longer off season. But as a reminder, she's a 75-kilogram lifter and she is known for her bench, not to disparage her squat or deadlift. They are both extremely strong, but, she is just casually, repping out 315 for doubles with pauses and not in a peak. So, jeez. Yeah. Big things coming. Everybody is always at her bench, but that is exciting.
Yeah.
And my final lift, sorry, I have to open it up in a different area, is Hunter Henderson. So Hunter is in prep and she had her final heavy squat before her meet and she squatted 665, which I believe the most she had done before was 650. Don't quote me. That could be wrong. But what I appreciate, so she lost her balance, in the squat. She stood it up, but in her caption, she even says like, you know, thanks for those who kept me safe. I'm uninjured and very grateful. And then she gives herself three red lights basically. So she like says the weight and then it's with three red lights. And what I mean, of course, that's absurdly impressive. That is so much weight and that's so fucking cool. But what I really want to like highlight here is the transparency, because I feel like a lot of times, like myself included, Instagram becomes like your highlight reel. And so people forget that the elites struggle with these sorts of days and these sorts of things happening to them too. They just push through it and, they train through it and oftentimes don't share that. And so I just wanted to draw some attention to that, that she's like sharing that, as it would turn out, Hunter is a human being, contradictory to popular belief, but yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I am not a huge fan of the whole like, oh, remember Instagram is a highlight reel like thing. I just like, I just am kind of over people speaking like that, but it does have a modicum of truth to it, right? Like, you know, I don't post my failures very often on Instagram, like, because it's just like not what I want to share. And so you can keep that in mind. Everyone struggles.
Yes, 100%.
Well, you were just at the APF Women's Pro-Am competing, but I do believe you're also going to do a short recap of how that went.
Yeah. So let's keep in mind that this was a 2-day meet. There was a amateur day and then a pro day. and there was Equipped and then Classic Raw. And just as a reminder for everybody, Classic Raw is unequipped, but you wear wraps and you can wear sleeves if you want to. You cannot wear both at the same time. And then Equipped is
knee
obviously
wraps, to clarify for folks, knee wraps.
Oh yeah.
Not other
Thank
things.
You, Jess. Yes. So just a reminder of that. So I'm going to just be covering the top three women and then just a special mention from both categories. Something to keep in mind, this is an APF meet. So in the APF, they use a different formula for best lifter, and that is the Glossbrenner. What's kind of, what I think is very cool about this formula is they explicitly publish exactly what it is. You could create your own Excel spreadsheet and figure it out yourself. Whereas a lot of these coefficients, I think the new Wilks is this way, Dots is this way. It's very challenging to get the equation. So this is a very
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So this one, they literally give you your coefficient, and they also include an age coefficient as well. So if you're older, then they take that into consideration.
Which I totally thought that Wilks and Dodds did that.
I don't think that they do. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before in my life.
I do not understand the lack of transparency in the other coefficients. It doesn't make sense to me. But I digress.
I don't digress. This one time at a meet. What meet was I at? It doesn't matter because I don't want to publicly shade the person who is taking the time out of their life to put on a meet for us. But it got to best lifter time, and my friend Sarah, absolutely, without a doubt, was the best lifter, by Wilks, by Dots, but Dots didn't exist yet, but by every coefficient that existed at the time, she was best lifter. We knew it. It comes to time for them to announce the best lifter, and they announced a different name. And we were all just sitting there, in shock, what the heck? Her coach is not taking this, and so goes over and is excuse me. What? How did you get to that? And the meet director was we took her total and divided it by her body weight and multiplied it by her age and all of this stuff. And it was that's not how you get the coefficient. And she was how do you get the coefficient? And we're that's the point. Nobody knows. You have to plug it into the calculator. They publish an Excel spreadsheet online and you download it and you use that. And that's all. There's also online calculators in case you needed to figure out what yours is going to be or was. But anyway, I digress. It's not that simple unless you're in the APF, I guess, where you have a coefficient and it's all published super transparently. Good God, I digress now. So, so the special mention is going to be Leah. So Leah was an early favorite.
Leah Reichman. There we go.
Mm-hmm. So she was an early favorite, but unfortunately she bombed out on bench. So she just kept having missed grooves, and the same thing happened with her squat. We all kind of walked into that meet expecting a 1,000 pounds on her back. She opened with a 5-pound PR, which means that it was a world record by 5 pounds. Unfortunately, the reason why I'm including all of this is for educational purposes. She registered as all three events for the day. She didn't register as squat only. So that means that she needed to complete all three events that day in order to secure that world record. So unfortunately it does not count. I was putting baby powder on my legs and she was standing there talking about why they chose not to take a token bench. And this was just the biggest quit energy I've ever heard in my life. She was it's only a 5-pound PR for a world record. We would have taken a token bench if it was 20 or 30-pound world record. And I was oh my God.
Oh,
because it's her own world record she's breaking. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah. So then moving on to the rest of the multiply ladies, Deanna DeAndrea, she ended up getting number one. She was on 183 body weight. She got an 1805 total with a 750 squat, a 500 bench, and a 575 deadlift.
Man, unreasonable. Girls are crazy. Yeah.
Rebecca Roberts, she was a 181 body weight, 1720 pound total, squatted 660, benched 45, deadlifted 575 as well. And then Miss Amber Hansen, she weighed in at 205 body weight. She got that 1805 total.
Nice.
She squatted 800 pounds. I'll say it louder. She squatted 800 pounds.
Has she gotten close to that before?
I think she has.
That was a huge PR.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And then she also, she made a post about this, but she was having some issues with her sumo deadlift or her suited deadlift or something. So they made the choice to have her deadlift raw with conventional.
And she got third place.
Yep. And she deadlifted 530. Yeah. So that's crazy. And she totaled 1800 plus. So 1805. So
wow,
that's exciting.
I can't wait to see what that total is going to look like when she gets that deadlift figured out.
Seriously. Yeah. She gets all healed up and stuff. But then moving over to wraps, we have Vanessa Torres. She weighed in. Yeah. So she weighed in 123 body weight and she totaled 1130. Oh my God. Wow. She squatted 485, benched 245. And I was actually next up and I got to watch her like absolutely lose her mind in celebration. So I think that was a PR that she was hankering for. Mm. And then she also deadlifted 400. And let me tell you, the entire room got up and was like screaming their faces off. And it was not unprompted. She is such a like a crowd worker. She like, mm-hmm. you know, gets up there and like demands it. She's like, give me the vibe, give me the feel. I need your energy. So yeah, it was pretty freaking sick. and then Susan Salazar, she was 132 body weight. She totaled 1160 with a 450 squat, 220 bench, and 490 deadlift, which is insane.
That is a huge deadlift.
Yeah, 490 at 132 body weight. What is that? Let's see here. That is 3.7 times body weight. That's insanity. That's insane, y'all. Like, the fact that that's becoming normal. Like,
yeah. I was also wondering where Vanessa's performance puts her all time. But that is something that we'll have to touch on a little later date, because we don't have time to go to open powerlifting and open that up.
do it? No. Okay. And then Jessica Springer, she weighed in with 260 body weight. And let me tell you, she worked very quietly, because I honestly, you know, she wasn't like demanding all the attention. She was just in and out like a friggin' sniper. like seriously, she squatted 615.
Wow.
Which is crazy. She benched 415.
PR for her?
It's not. I think interestingly enough, I think she matched exactly her lifts from exactly a year prior, which is pretty wild. But I don't know how her body weight has fluctuated. So, it may be a PR to her.
Yeah, I think she's gone down. I believe that she weighed in heavier a year ago. That looks like a lighter number than I've seen for her in the past.
Well, then, hell yeah. And then, she deadlifted 630. So, absolutely insane. The vibe was immaculate. And, you know, I've said this a lot. Like, if you guys are looking to fall back in love with powerlifting, like you're having a rough time getting that like serotonin rush, and you know that feeling like in your wrists when you're like excited for a lift, like you're anxious and excited and nervous. Mm-hmm. I hadn't had that in years, and I didn't realize that until this meet because I got it in full force. So yeah, if you're depressy spaghetti, go to this meet.
Oh my gosh.
Jess, I think there was something you wanted to touch on regarding some changes.
Yeah, so Open Powerlifting obviously like keeps track of a lot of our powerlifting rankings, but I think that not all of the equipped federations report to Open Powerlifting. Mm-hmm. And there is a man named Michael Soong who keeps the historical records of women's equipped powerlifting. Actually, Cassette Neely is the woman who works with him to keep track of the women's, and he keeps track of the men's as well. And so one of the lists that they keep is the women's 1,700 pound total Hall of Fame. So it's like one of those benchmarks in equipped powerlifting to hit a 1,700 pound total. It reminds me of in high school, I don't know if you ever experienced this, but like the different like clubs that you could be in based on what gym total you hit in your high school. I don't know if that was a thing. We had it in our, I was the only girl in any of ours. Anyways, I digress.
we were told we weren't allowed to lift as girls in high school. So
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That. Thank you for your support. Anyhow.
So they have a list of 18 women who have hit these totals, and there were quite a few women who got on here for the first time or improved their numbers. So that includes Rebecca Roberts. I believe this was her first time hitting her 1,700 pound total, or she improved it, and that happened at this at the Pro-Am. Another person would be Deanna D'Andrea, who won the meet for the equipped. And she, I think she was already on that list, but she improved it because her total was that 1805. Amber Hansen improved hers on there. I'll also just run down the top few. Obviously, Becca Swanson still has that number one spot. She's the first woman to total 1,600, 1,700, 1,800, 1,900, and 2,000 pounds.
Are you serious? I didn't know that.
I am serious.
Whoa. Yes. Wait, quick question. Did she do those like in a row consecutively, or did she like happen to do them all at the same time? Like, did she just walk in and total 2 grand, or did she like total 1,600, then 1,700, then 1,800?
That one.
Okay. That's cool.
She was way ahead of her time because she was doing this in the early 2000s. Like, I believe she hit her heaviest total in 2005.
Wow.
Leah Reichman has the number 2 and the number 3 spot. I don't really know what that's about, but Becca Swanson also has the 4 and 5 spot. So I don't fully understand. I think it's just number of times you've hit those totals. So he puts you up there every time.
Yeah, fair enough. As like a distinct ranking.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And then Crystal Tate is 6th. Amber is 7th. And Amber is one of the lighter women on in that top 10, along with Deanna, who's 8th, Crystal Tate again for 9th, Laura Phelps is 10th, and I believe Laura is the one who put on the meet, right?
Laura is, oh my gosh, let me tell you this, girl. At the end of the meet, the announcer did a fabulous job of paying tribute to Laura. I mean, she's alive and kicking, y'all. She put on the meet. Phrase that poorly.
Yeah.
But she, yeah. No, she's, yeah, she is, yeah, she's phenomenal. She's super friggin' nice. She's very inclusive. And she had a list of accomplishments, records, everything you can think of that literally took the announcer like 2 to 3 minutes. That doesn't sound like a long time. That's a long time to just read off people's like accomplishments.
And yeah,
it was each one. It wasn't like, okay, yeah, cool. It was like each one I was shitting a brick, like individual bricks. I probably shat like 25 bricks in the course of them reading. Anyway, sorry. The point is, these are like Hall of Famers, and I feel like I wasn't familiar with her until this podcast, and I feel like they deserve more credit. You know, always hear about the male counterparts who have that list of rap sheet or shorter, but not these women OGs. You know,
right? Yeah. But yeah, so that is the women's all-time list, just a chunk of it. We'll maybe link to that page on our Instagram. And we are going to transition over to our interview with Dr. Stacey Morris now. So enjoy. We're live.
Dr. Stacey, the physio fix.
Yeah, Dr. Stacey, do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, first off, thanks for having me on your guys' podcast. I'm excited to be here, especially talk to the strength audience, because being a lifter myself. But let me give you a quick little background. So my name is Dr. Stacey Barber. I'm a physical therapist. I'm also an Olympic weightlifter. I was formerly a collegiate gymnast, and I went to Duke University. I graduated back in 2015 and started working for someone else at first until I decided that I really kind of wanted to do my own thing and create my entire new model of physical therapy. So I branched out and opened up the PhysioFix and just started doing the solopreneur route in a private practice, where shared space. And then in 2020, during the pandemic, I opened up my entire facility. So now I own this big practice in Phoenix, Arizona, and I have 12 people that work alongside me, and we are just here to change the world.
Nice.
Wow, that's so much. Well, so speaking of credentials and how many people you have on staff, right? You've got quite a few behind your name: DPT, CSCS, FRC. Would you mind walking us through those and what they all mean?
Yeah, so the first two initials are PT, and that just means that I've graduated from a PT program and I'm a licensed physical therapist. And then DPT, that means I have my doctorate a physical therapy degree. And then after that, we go by, you know, alphabetical order. So CSCS, I'm a certified strength and conditioning specialist. And then next is FRCMS. So I'm a functional range conditioning mobility specialist. And then after that is USAWL1SP. And that's a level one USA weightlifting coach. And there's a lot of other ones too, but those are like the main ones that I share, because that's pretty much the audience that I speak to and the people that I want to work with.
Awesome. Makes sense. So you kind of started to talk about being a solo entrepreneur, and the things that you've been building, especially since 2020. But we were wondering, you know, physical therapy is a highly competitive field. Even after, you know, the requirements have changed a little bit towards DPT, but you have found a lot of success, especially working with gymnasts and weightlifters and things like that. And now that you have your own practice, your own gym, people that work under you, what do you feel was like the biggest catalyst to your success?
I've always said that the biggest thing is that I know how to connect with people, and I feel like I can simplify like pretty complex information too, so it's easy to digest. And that's why I got on Instagram. It wasn't necessarily to like grow a huge following. It was more so to share educational information to like my friends and family back home, which is on the East Coast, and now I live on the West Coast, and they were always asking me questions, and I just wanted to share some knowledge with them to be like, you can fix these things on your own, here's how. And so I just started posting things and sharing it to my mom, my sister, like friends, family, and it just started growing from there. So I think that's one of the big reasons that I've been successful, is because I can take the complex and make it simple. And I think people appreciate that. And it's also valuable information, and it helps and it works. So I think that's some of the things that have helped, but other things is just more so like my background of being a gymnast and an Olympic weightlifter. So I talk the talk, I walk the walk, and I think that that's, you know, it's relatable. So I know exactly what everyone's going through if you're a strength athlete. You know, I've been there. I know what it feels like to be injured and sidelined, and I just want to be the person to help get you back on the platform. So that's, I think, why personally, why I've been able to grow. And then the other clinicians within my space, they all have their specialties too. So I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. So you're very popular on Instagram. You you get a lot of following on your videos, which are super helpful. Have you branched out to TikTok at all? Or do you have like a YouTube following as well?
So YouTube, I think I have 11,000 subscribers now. So nothing tremendous, but I can monetize it now with ads, right?
Yeah.
So I've been posting, I actually recently ruptured my Achilles and I've been rehabbing that. So I've been doing like a weekly vlog on there. And so I'll go through all my rehab and then just my own accelerated protocol and sharing that. So I've been trying to grow my YouTube that way. But TikTok, I've still not kind of gone into that route. I just feel like for me, it just, I spend so much time on Instagram that I would have to hire someone else to focus more on TikTok. And it was, should probably be someone that's like a teenager. Right. Because that's the people that know how to make all the TikToks. And I'm thinking maybe this summer I'm going to hire someone who is a teenager and then just have them manage my TikTok page.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds like a great job for an intern. Social media managers are a thing. It's a very challenging field. I will say, by the way, one of the things having worked with you that I really appreciated was exactly what you said, like being able to break down exactly why you're giving the exercises you're giving in a like palatable way. So I understand why I'm doing these things. And it helps with buy-in because as soon as I understood why you were giving me that exercise, I did it like religiously. But, you know, if you just don't know why you're doing it and you're just going through the motions, like it's hard to keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. If I could tell you that, you know, this is going to help your elbows get into a better position and then you're going to be more stable when you're squatting, then you're like, well, I want to be more stable. I want to hit higher numbers. That makes sense. So just being able to like relate it back to whatever the goals are of the person that I'm working with is huge in just creating the buy-in, like you said.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and I've had physical therapy experiences where they were not lifters and it can be really frustrating to be told like, oh, like don't lift more than 135 pounds or like, you know, maybe you should go for a run, like things like that. Like, I've definitely experienced like even in like sports medicine practices, people who like just don't get it. So I can imagine it's really helpful to have for your patients to have someone who gets it.
Absolutely. I have patients that come in all the time that their doctor that they went to see first, which you do not have to, anyone listening to this, you don't have to see a doctor before you come see a physical therapist, just so you know that we have, you know, direct access. So you can come straight to us. But the doctor, you know, said harmful things towards this patient of, you know, you should probably never squat again. You should never deadlift again. And those narratives are super harmful. And so when I like get them in the door for the first time for an evaluation, I now have to break those narratives and have to reframe them. And that just takes so much longer to create buy-in and for them to feel like I can actually help them when if they came straight to me, I could have, you know, explained things a lot easier than just like said that really harsh statement of never do this again, which is not an actual realistic answer. Right?
No.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. When it breaks your heart for a doctor to say something like that to you, you know? Yeah. But, well, so I will say when we worked together, you did dry needling on me. What is your general approach with clients? Do you like have something that you always do, a general approach?
No, it's going to be based on the individual in front of me. So there's no one size fits all for anything or any person. So it's going to be like, okay, one, have you had experience with dry needling or cupping and like what's worked for you in the past? Because you want to do things that have worked for someone in the past first, and then you can start, you know, changing things down the line. But if you know it works for them, you might want to do that, right? So we have to, you know, gauge like what's their background with physical therapy. Have they had this before? Are you afraid of needles? Because if you're afraid of needles, you're probably not going to do needling, right? And I've had people like get really, really scared of needling. And so those people just don't respond well to dry needling, and it's not going to create buy-in, and they're not going to feel like they're leaving here feeling better. They're probably going to feel like, wow, she just pressured me to get needled and I didn't want that and I did not enjoy that and I'm never coming back. So I have lots of tools at my disposal. I do cupping, I do dry needling. You know, we have percussion guns, just soft tissue massage, joint mobilizations, joint manipulation, so I can like crack someone's back. I can do all those sort of things, but everything's going to come down to the person in front of me and what I think is going to be best for them. And we have a conversation to figure out if they also agree that they want to try whatever I think is best. And if not, no hard feelings, you know, we're going to do what's best for each person. So that's usually what we do in the room if I do anything. And then after that, I always tell everyone that manual therapy creates short-term effects. So it's really just kind of like band-aiding things. It's not fixing anything that's the underlying problem. The real thing that's going to fix the underlying problem is the exercises we implement to improve your mobility, your strength, your stability, whatever you're lacking, your deficits. Those are the long-term answers, right? So that's usually what I spend a majority of my time doing, because I consider myself a movement-based clinician.
Yeah.
I mean, that perfectly matches like my experience with you. I came to you, my elbows were in such pain, I think that time that... that I couldn't even move them. I couldn't do the drills until you did the dry needling, and then it opened me up enough at least to do the movements, right? So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you also share a lot of free information on your page, a lot of movement-based corrective exercises, and it looks like you get a lot of positive response. People appreciate it a ton. Do you have, in that vein, any tips for people at home who are looking at these how-to and mobility and prehab videos, like yours and other people's videos as well? And then also, like, are there any red flags to look for content on the internet that's not yours?
Yeah, I say that obviously it's always best to get evaluated by somebody before you like just find some exercises that you think may help. Because the biggest one for me is when people see things on the internet for like low back pain or like that has like sciatica or some like radiating pain in their legs. Sometimes it's coming from the back. Sometimes it's coming from the hips. So if you see a post that you're like, this resonates with me, this is what I'm experiencing, and you do things for the back, but it's really coming from the hips, you could be, you know, doing the entirely wrong things that are not going to get you better at all. So one, it's like, make sure you read the caption too, because I always say like, disclaimer, this isn't, you know, for everybody. You know, if it's not coming from the back, then it might be coming from the hips. So if these don't work for you, you might need to refer to these other things that would be helpful for you. But not every clinician says that or has those disclaimers. So just be careful what you're reading and take everything with a grain of salt that it may work for you, but it also may not work for you. And it's always going to be best to get evaluated by someone, which is why we do those, you know, online appointments and online consultations to be able to, you know, discuss with people, like, what are the different options and figure out what it actually is coming from, so you don't get misled by whatever you see on, you know, social media. So I think that's an important tidbit for everyone to keep in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I, right when the pandemic started, we did an online, I don't know, even consultation, is that what you would call it? Up for my patellar tendon. And I was so scared. I thought that I had ruptured something, or I had no idea what was wrong. It was right at the beginning of the pandemic, so it was very difficult to get in with anyone. And so I was so happy that you had those online services. Are those very common now, or is that a large part of your intake now, is online?
Yeah, so I was doing so many of those, you know, during the pandemic that I decided to kind of open up different days. So I was just doing like once a month of online appointments, like pre-pandemic. So I already had the service, you know, and it was already set up. So I didn't have to like scramble to kind of build something from scratch, like a lot of other people had to. But now I've integrated it into my schedule. So Monday I have like off day, and then Tuesday I'm just in person with patients. Wednesday morning I do online appointments, and then Wednesday afternoon I do in-person appointments. Thursday morning, I do online appointments, and then nothing in the afternoon. And then Friday, I'm just in person. So I already have two built-in days now that I have like a 5 hours each day that I do online, you know, video calls or consultations. So it's been nice to have this like this other kind of income source coming in, as well as the ability to help more people all across the world, because not everyone has access to the same amount of like top quality physical therapy, and especially in other countries. And I'll like meet with people from, you know, Russia. I'll meet with people in, from China. I've had people from Japan that needed an interpreter to talk with me, and they're a high level Olympic weightlifter, and they don't have anyone. Like, physical therapy there is all manual based. So being able to like offer them some exercise suggestions or ideas to implement into their program is incredibly helpful, because it's just like eye opening, because they've never experienced that. They've never been given any guidance.
Wow. I got like goosebumps a couple
times. Yeah, that's powerful.
It's very important. Yeah. Well, I guess kind of in that same vein, this is going to be a really high level question, right? But what are the most common preventable issues and injuries that you see in those strength athletes?
So nothing is completely preventable. So the correct term that we like to use is we want to reduce the risk of getting X, Y, or Z. So that's kind of how we have to phrase it, because if you call it just injury prevention, that doesn't really exist, because there's all these external factors that come into play, environmental factors, stuff like that. So if we're talking about things that we can reduce the risk of getting injured in strength sports, I would say low back pain, knee pain, and shoulder pain. Those three, they're the big three, like joints, right? I mean,
I was like, check.
Yeah. In the weightlifter world, we call it like weightlifter's knee. Such a common thing. You know, then there's a lot of people that have like shoulder and elbow pain, usually like at the same time, or one that precedes the other one. And those are kind of the same thing going on there. And then there's a lot of like low back pain, or even like people that start to like move differently because they have low back pain, and then start getting like some anterior hip pain or pinching and stuff like that in their squats. So all of these kind of go hand in hand. And what it comes down to, I would say most of the time, is like for the knee pain, it's for lack of ankle mobility. You would be so surprised to see, if I like looked at everyone's ankles, there's like 5 people out of 100 that would pass the ankle test. And if you are like a high bar back squatter, you need great ankle mobility, right? If you're a low bar back squatter, you can get away with not so great ankle mobility. But for the people that want a high bar back squat, and all those weightlifters, that's what the movement pattern is. They have terrible ankle mobility, and they wonder why their knees hurt.
That checks out. I have a friend who actually just, she moved and got a new coach and all this, and she started posting her side angle squats. And all of a sudden, you know, before she was just barely breaking parallel, and all of a sudden she's ass to grass. And I was like, what's your secret? What changed? And she was like, I've never worked on my ankle mobility. And I did like literally 2 drills. I was like, God. And her strength is just the same. It was just a mobility issue. It's wild.
And I'm another one of those things too, which isn't really a secret, but people like top level powerlifters, you know, strongman competitors, Olympic weightlifters, we don't train unilaterally as much as we should be, because when we're training for a competition, you know, it's all about just getting those numbers and getting those reps in on like the main lifts that you're going to be doing and competing. And we just kind of like let everything go by the wayside, the other stuff that we know is important, but it's like, this is more important at this point because we're about to compete, right? So, you know, training more unilaterally or like contralaterally and doing some of those exercises, that's all you need really for like low back pain, for good preventative stuff, is just making sure that you train more unilaterally.
Yeah. As soon as my specificity goes up, like immediately I'm like, I got to really work on all of my mobility stuff because it's about to get gnarly.
So first question is, do you work with Gen Pop patients? And if so, is your approach different with athletes versus Gen Pop patients?
I do work with Gen Pop. I work with anyone that wants to work with me or that can get on my schedule. Sometimes it's hard to get on my schedule these days with just like limited availability because I have limited in-person. And so it's actually easier to work with me online right now because I just usually see people once every 5 weeks online versus like, you know, once or twice a week in person. So yes, I work with Gen Pop, and the treatment strategy is the exact same because I look at everyone the same way. I assess them. I ask them the same questions, like what are your goals? When do you want to get back to? And just because they're not an athlete doesn't mean that they don't have goals that they want to go back to. And, you know, once we prioritize that and I figure out like, okay, this is the best treatment strategy to get you to those goals, then it's the same thing. Do I do manual? Sometimes. Do I do exercises? Always. And then they might be coming in infrequently, like once, you know, every couple weeks. I have some people that come like once every 3 months, just like a check-in, like maintenance appointment. And those are more Gen Pop patients that I give them the tools they need to help themselves on their own. And then they just kind of visit me infrequently, which is awesome because now it's kind of like, you know, like a check-in. So you can do a tune-up for your car, you do preventative stuff for your teeth, right? But now we don't really do a lot of preventative stuff for our bodies. And I would love for everyone to kind of take that same approach and come in infrequently and get some new tools to add into your routine and just start feeling good.
I've heard it called prehab. That's at least what I've always like called it for myself. Is like these are drills that I could use in rehab, but I'm not broken right now. So and what you were saying about goal setting with non-athletes, I imagine that helps with buy-in with Gen Pop as well, like setting smart goals for them.
Yeah, everyone has goals. You just have to ask the right questions to be able to get the goals out of them. And usually like during my evaluation, like they might not be like forthcoming with those goals at first, but later on they'll be like, you know what? I would like to be able to run again without knee pain. And I'm like, cool, let's make that one of your goals. Like maybe we won't run today because you haven't done any strength training in 6 years. But, you know, if we start doing strength training and build that foundational strength, you can absolutely get back to this goal. And so I just like to see like their eyes like light up, be like, really, I can get back to lifting and running and I'll be okay. And I'm like, yeah, like you just have to be like upfront and transparent with whoever you're working with and let them know every single goal that you have. And every good provider should be able to help you come up with a plan to reach those goals.
I like setting that expectation for like any provider, honestly, not just PTs, but yeah, but any other plan. I feel like that shouldn't be a high bar, but
you'd be surprised.
So I know you said that you don't have, you know, a difference in approach between Gen Pop and athletes, but I'm wondering, you know, you already mentioned like weightlifters, for instance, weightlifters' knee is really common. If there are other like common injuries that you see between different sports or for different sports, and then also like if there's any like common modalities that like a lot of people in a particular sport like get a lot of success with you.
So for strongman, Jessica, that side of things, I see a lot of elbow pain and a lot of shoulder pain, you know, being able to like, you know, push things overhead. There's a lot of like stability that comes with needing to do those exercises. And I feel like that's where a lot of people kind of miss the ball because they lack a little bit of shoulder stability or they lack a little bit of rotator cuff strength. So working on that stuff seems to be incredibly helpful. And then improving shoulder mobility, which will take off stress from the elbow. So then they're not relying on their elbow joint to do the work that the shoulder joint should be helping out with.
Yeah.
That's been really, really helpful for strongman competitors. And a low back pain. That's another big one with strongman competitors, you know, pulling all of the heavy weight or, you know, pulling the trucks and the axle carries, all that stuff. It just like puts a lot of like load on your body. And then it all comes back to same thing. It's just like, sometimes you just have to calm things down for those competitors because they do so much and their volume is so high because they're training a multitude of different things at the same time that you just have to get back to some of the basics of just like, let's do some hip strengthening. And it's not like basic hip strengthening. It's just like things that you probably haven't been focusing on, hip strengthening stuff to improve, you know, just the overall like tissue capacity of the hips and improve the mobility and the joint health of the hips. And that's going to help once again, take off stress from the back. So that those are like the three biggest things I see in strongman competitors. For powerlifters, I would say the biggest ones are, like we already talked about, low back pain. Same sort of thing. It's just, you know, pulling so much weight so frequently, just, you know, your body's, you know, needs time to rest. And sometimes I think it's not overtraining, it's under recovering and not implementing the right recovery, you know, methods like mobility exercises at the right time. Because I feel like we can train at high capacities. Like if you look at the Russian weightlifters or the Chinese weightlifters, They're training 7 days a week, 2 to 3 times a day.
Yeah.
That's a lot of volume. So is it really like we're in America not able to tolerate the same workload? No, we can like slowly build capacity the same way that they can, but they have all like the best recovery techniques that they've been implementing for years. So then they're able to just like handle the demands a lot better, you know? So that's one for powerlifting. Another one, like I said, the elbow pain in low bar back squatters. That one is really, really big. And that's once again, back to like Brittany and I were working on this too, is the lack of shoulder external rotation mobility. So if you don't have that good mobility, then the stress comes on the elbow, that medial side of the elbow. And you might also start experiencing that medial elbow pain when you're bench pressing. So that's pretty big. And then, you know, the knee pain. So a lot of lifters get knee pain. And I would say I see a lot of hip pain in powerlifters too. So like that hip pinching or hip impingement, maybe they were told that they needed to do a sumo and then their hips, just their anatomy isn't the best for sumo. And so going back to conventional might be better for their body type. So knowing how to like assess is huge in that regards, because I can look at their hips and be like, you know what, you are more externally rotated naturally. You probably would do really well with a sumo, or you need a toe up more in a squat, stuff like that. But if you're more like straight on or even like pigeon-toed naturally, then forcing yourself to be in the external rotation is really going to cause a lot of pinching and grinding of that hip joint. So those are the ones I see that's big in powerlifting. For Olympic weightlifting, it is definitely the weightlifter's knee. And then a lot of this like mid shoulder blade pain from like where the bar sits and the compression of the bar when they're doing so much back squatting. So that's really big too. And then shoulder stability. So a lot of shoulder pain, cause just like the snatching and the jerking.
Yeah.
I'll say just having that, like for fun crossing over, the snatch is the one that like always scared me the most of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And this is so like outside of the powerlifting, like, you know, everything is just very in line. Well, as far as crossover between strength training and rehab, have you found that there's any sort of correlation with like physical capability or strength and pain level tolerance? Like, I don't know if you're able to like accept a lot more pain. is there any sort of correlation with strength, or do you think that that's just honestly irrelevant?
I think it's more subjective. So everyone's like individual experiences are just different. And so that your pain level or your like your capacity to handle pain is different. I think definitely being someone that's competitive in any sort of sport, you probably have you just want to push things a little bit more. So you probably want, you are usually are like willing to go into pain a little bit more, as opposed to someone that might not be like have a goal in mind. They might like step back more so. So I would say, I don't know if there's a correlation for like, you know, strength sports and pain, but I know that people that do strength sports are willing to go through some pain if they're like, you know, planning on competing or if they have like a goal in mind at the end of that pain, you know?
Yeah, I definitely would agree. My boyfriend is not a competitive lifter of any kind. And when he experiences pain, he's like, well, that's it for the day. I'm going to go ahead and pack this up. I'll go do some hamstring and bye. And I'm like, really? I'm going to go and sit down and do a bunch of mobility for the next 45 minutes and then come back and try again.
It's a different mindset, right? Mindset is completely different from people that don't have that, like that goal or that vision or that mindset. So I think that that's probably a guiding light as well.
Do you think that there are some times when competitive people like take it too far, like they're experiencing pain in their training that they probably shouldn't be working through, that they should be like taking a step back and trying to fix?
Absolutely. And I feel like the closer you get to a competition, the more that you're willing to push through some of those higher pain numbers, right? Because, you know, you're like, oh, well, tomorrow's a rest day. Like, it's okay if I go to a 10 out of 10 out of pain today because I'm going to take tomorrow off. And it's like, is it really okay? Or now are you set back 3 days because you kind of, you overreached, right? So we have like, everyone has a threshold. And if you exceed the threshold, then you're going to be like suffering for whatever your normal, like, you know, period is. So like I can recover within, you know, 48 hours. It might take someone else 72. Someone might recover in 24. So once you kind of know yourself, you know, like how to gauge that. But I feel like the closer we are, the more we push it. And I feel like I see a lot of lifters, you know, just kind of keep pushing that threshold, and they shut down after a while because they're in so much pain. But, you know, at the same point, we all have these goals to be athletes. And sometimes that's kind of the athlete mindset or the athlete mentality, is to be able to, like, you know, push harder than other people, you know, to be able to achieve greatness. And sometimes you have to suffer to achieve greatness. But I always tell patients that everyone's subjective scale is different. But if you exceed a 6 out of 10 on your subjective scale, that's a stopping point. So more than that, we know we're probably doing more damage than good. And below that, you're probably like, you're stressing it, but you're still under your threshold. And so you're not going to feel the repercussions afterwards. So just use that number, you know, to guide, should I stop today or and come back tomorrow, or should I keep pushing?
Yeah, I'm over here like, oh, okay, noted.
Yeah, even in the passive modalities that I get from my physical therapist, he is always telling me, if you're going over a 6 or a 7 when I'm doing this work on you, you have to tell me, because that's not the point of this. The point is not to like push you up to that pain level.
Yeah, it's a lot of nervous system too, because at that point, like if you put your nervous system into overdrive, now your nervous system also has to recover. So the tissue has to recover on a tissue level, but now your nervous system is going to be also having to recover. And we're now in a sympathetic fight or flight response. And so now that's going to take longer to come back down to a parasympathetic state, and that can throw everything out of whack.
Yeah. And you think about like hormone levels, like cortisol levels, and exactly. How that can affect, yep, like if you have to do a weight cut or whatever. Yeah. I had a moment with my physical therapist like maybe a month ago where I had experienced like an event of like upper back pain in a lift and decided to push through it. And my adrenaline took over for the rest of the workout. So I didn't feel it. Like I had the event, I sat down, and then my adrenaline kicked in and I was like, oh, so it was fine because I didn't have pain during that. And he was like, actually, like, no, like your body masked it. But like you said, then like your sympathetic nervous system was just firing on all cylinders. So it was, yep, a good learning moment for me.
And that's sometimes the best, right? Like, I mean, you can tell people until you're blue in the face, like, okay, do this and do this, do this. But sometimes you have to experience it for yourself. And once you, like, you do, and you kind of push past where you should have stopped, you know what that feels like. So the next time, maybe you're going to be more likely to stop when you need to stop because you've experienced it. So, you know, I think experiences is a very helpful teacher.
Yep. That's 100% what happened in the past 2 months. are there issues unique to women athletes that you see in your work with patients?
Pelvic floor. Yes, for sure. Urinary incontinence. You know, I was at a strongman meet recently and they said, you know, if you see someone pee on the platform, like it's normal, keep it moving and we're just going to clean it up and not say anything about it. That they made the announcement over the speaker. And I was like, I'm glad that they've like, you know, say something, because, you know, it is embarrassing when that happens to the person. And then like, you know, if you've never been to a competition, then you don't know what to expect or what's normal. So it was nice to like hear them say something about it. But for them to say that it was normal, I was like, I wish they would have phrased that a little bit differently, because just because it's common doesn't mean it's normal. And I think that a lot of people think that, you know, it's okay, or like that it's never going to be like better. And that's not true at all. A lot of people can help you, you know, so you don't have to experience those embarrassing moments on the platform when you're lifting heavy or jump roping or running or coughing or sneezing. You know, it's like, it doesn't have to be lifting related, but that's something common that happens in women, especially women that have already bared children, is they have more urinary incontinence and more leakage when they're doing exercise.
Yeah, it's such a fine line between like, making it so women don't
feel like they can't lift or can't compete because they have this, but also empowering them to seek care for it. It's a fine line because you never want to shame someone, but you do want them to seek help. And, you know, I have a friend, actually, we've had her on the podcast who she's been to like 3 different physical therapists for her SUI and it hasn't worked. And for her, she was just like, I've exhausted all of my capabilities through insurance to try to fix this. And so for some women, it doesn't, but if you never try, how will you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not just specific to, you know, like I said, exercise induced urinary incontinence, but it could just be like when you're sneezing and stuff like that. So like you said, if you never tried to seek like care for this or have someone help you there, you could be doing the wrong thing first off, because when you know how like my mother used to say like Kegels, you know, Kegels are the answer for everything, right? Like do Kegels. And now we know that in physical therapy, and I'm not a pelvic floor physical therapist at all, but I have like baseline knowledge of, you know, to be able to have these conversations with patients and be able to refer out. We know that Kegels are the wrong thing to do most of the time. So like 80% of women have a hypertonic pelvic floor. That means that they already carry so much tension within their pelvic floor that if you do Kegels, you kind of create more tension. And so doing those things is actually very harmful. You need to learn how to become more in that parasympathetic state. So everything relaxes a little bit better. And then when you want to turn it on and you need to turn it on, you can, versus it being so tight all the time, then you can't make it tighter whenever you need to, right? When you're lifting. So those things like that I was taught when I was younger are extremely harmful and don't help most people.
Yeah. I had never heard of that before.
I had like girl gym bro advice given to me when I was first starting of like, just do Kegels. And I fully did and didn't really get better. It's just like, okay. Yeah. And luckily I don't like experience it to a, you know, a really high degree, but now that you're telling me this, I'm like,
Yeah.
You looking into that then?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of really good providers out there. You know, they're all over Instagram too. They have like cute little like Instagram handles, but you can reach out to any of those people and they would be able to, you know, help you, and they don't have to do an internal exam if you're not about that. If you just want more of like that video consultation and like just to discuss kind of which one you are, because they'll be able to tell you a lot better than I could, because I'm going to stay in my own lane. I just know a little bit to make me dangerous, you know, but I'll like leave the stuff to the professionals, but you should definitely look into it.
I go ahead, Britt.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Jess and I are actually, I'm sure you've seen on Instagram, it's like a huge hot topic right now. Stress and athlete incontinence, right? And we were hoping to bring on a specialist just to speak to it, because there's also a lot of misinformation that's getting published too, like to your point, overstressing the normalcy as of it as opposed to how common it is. And Justin and I had kind of like drawn the parallel of like for men it would be like getting a nosebleed while you're squatting. Like, do a lot of men do it? Yes. Is it normal?
No. Right. No.
Yeah.
And I was similarly going to say, I really appreciate you, you know, mentioning your scope of practice, because I think a lot of people are commenting on it right now who don't actually know what they're talking about. And that's why, you know, Britt and I are hoping to get on a pelvic floor therapist so that we can just pitch it to someone, you know, punt it to someone who knows what they're talking about, so that we don't put out harmful information. And so I appreciate that in you as well. But even what you've given us is like, I'm like, oh wow, that's so helpful.
Yeah.
Once I learned that myself. So gymnastics is another sport, which is funny because I come from like want gymnastics. And then now obviously like, you know, I did powerlifting, bodybuilding, Olympic weightlifting. So different sports entirely, right? But tumble pee is like the most prevalent thing in gymnastics. There's like images of girls like on the cover of magazines, and you'll see this stream of pee when they're tumbling. And it, once again, you think it's just like common, it's normal, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so every patient that I get that's, you know, a gymnast too, I'll ask them about it. Like, hey, you know, this is what happened to me when I was your age. Do you experience this? And they all laugh and they're like, of course we do. And I'm like, it's still like being misperceived today that it's not something that is treatable, and it is very much treatable. And I'm not saying everyone's treatable, but there, it's worth like looking into. And when I was younger and I experienced this, they gave me a pee pill. They called it literally a pee pill. And it was like something that was supposed to like help my bladder. And it wasn't a bladder problem, right? It's more of a pelvic floor problem. And so it was just like the methods that they used way back then and the whole Kegel advice, it just can do more harm than good. So, you know, seeking out the right people is the most beneficial thing you could do.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Well, speaking of women and, you know, feeling safe in sports, being a woman athlete, trusting your body and well-being with a professional can be like really challenging, right? It can be honestly really scary if it's with a professional of the opposite sex or gender. Mm-hmm. Do you have any tips for women who are looking for a local PT in their area? Like any surefire signs of a safe space, things that the professional can do just to give you early signs that you are going to be comfortable and cared for?
I think getting a referral to someone is, you know, incredibly helpful. So then you already know, like, okay, so-and-so went and saw them, they had a good experience. And then asking them questions like, you know, can you tell me about your first encounter with this person? Just so you can like get the full understanding of like what it looked like. And were you like locked in a room together? Were you out in the open? Like, where were you? So then you know that you can feel safe in that space. And then like asking, you know, then like, do they have any lifting knowledge? You know, so if you're a lifter, it's really important to speak the same language and for your provider to understand your goals, which are not the same goals as, you know, just the gen pop. So, you know, even things like this urinary incontinence talk, like if they're not a lifter, they might not even know what that is or that is so prevalent in that population. So, there is a huge database called Clinical Athlete. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, mm-hmm. but it's a database that I'm on, and it's like, it's athletes that are also providers that work with athletes. So mm-hmm. I'm in there for powerlifters. I'm in there for Olympic weightlifters, for strongman. So I work with these athletes and I have experience, you know, doing some of this, not strongman as much as powerlifting and weightlifting, but, it has like everything broken down. And it says like, are you a physical therapist? Are you a chiropractor? Are you a massage therapist? So that's an entire directory. And it's people that have been vetted by professionals. And my like interview was 2 hours long. And I had to explain my entire treatment process. And I've been part of that group for like 7 years now. But it's incredibly helpful to be able to at least like have that buy-in factor that they know what they're doing and they are in part of this professional organization.
Absolutely. I had not heard about this. It sounds like Jess may have. I'm just going to go ahead and say we're going to put that in our link tree on our Instagram bio. Okay. So when this episode releases, check out the FemStrong page because that sounds like an immaculate resource I didn't know I had access to. So
yeah, it varies from state to state. So some states yep. have like a lot of options and some have less. But it's a really great, I know a lot of power lifters who have used that specifically for massage therapy. But physical therapy, I think, would be a really great way to do it too.
I was wanting eventually to kind of create my own database because I get people that ask me all the time because, you know, I've lived in like 10 states. So I have worked with so many different people all across like this country at least. So I know like who's good in which areas. So like creating my own little like database of people that I trust that I've actually like worked with directly and I know personally. And then, you know, like going person to person or provider to provider and actually like doing an in-person like evaluation of their treatment styles in order for them to get on that list, because it is something that people lack, you know, or they don't understand that there's a lot of variety and variability within like who you're going to go see. And so I just think it would be something that would be incredibly helpful for people.
Yeah, I agree.
Truly. I mean, Jess, you and I were literally just talking about this the other day, finding a massage therapist that gets your goals. I just happened to stumble upon one at like one of those, you know, common places where you get a membership. And I just got really lucky. I fully went into it just expecting a really, you know, preliminary, simple massage. Yeah. And they knew exactly what they were doing. I was like shocked. So that would be such a wonderful resource to have.
But keywords are big too. So like if you Google, you know, like physical therapist and then plus strongman or physical therapist plus powerlifting or, you know, anything like certain like criteria, then if, you know, if that's part of like their bio or something, and maybe they're not on the clinical athlete database, but maybe they're someone local to you that has that background, then I think that would at least like you know, you might want to have a, like a discovery call with them to kind of see like, you know, what they're about and what their treatment method is, because those are things that are important to ask too, you know, like what their philosophy is. Are they just do hands-on stuff? Do they do movement stuff? Like what you should expect to get out of your first appointment with them.
Well, especially if you're in a, like a rural area, speaking as someone who used to have to drive, you know, like an hour to see a specialist, it's really a huge letdown to drive that whole hour and get there and it not be what you really wanted. So, yeah, that, I mean, just picking up the phone can be so hard, but really, really helpful.
Well, Cece, that's all, or Dr. Cece, sorry, that's all we have as far as questions. Were there any other things that you wanted to share with our listeners?
No, other than if anyone wants to work with me, I do, you know, these video calls every Wednesday and Thursday, so you can book an online appointment with me and I will give you guys that information so you can share it with them. And I also offer online programs. So if you just don't have the financial means to visit with someone in person, one of my big goals with opening my practice was to be able to like offer rehab that's affordable for people. And that's why I created these like template based rehab programs that are specific to, you know, shoulder pain or low back pain. And it's exactly what I use with my patients in person. And I packaged it neatly and put it into an app. So there's a video of everything and it tells you exactly what to do. And if you have any questions, you can always reach out to me.
Awesome. Having used that app, it's wonderful. I'm just going to give it a review right now, just so you guys know. I have fully used it myself and it worked wonders. My patellar tendonitis immediately stopped flaring. So Stacy knows what's up, Dr. Stacy.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Stacy, do you want to share maybe where they can find you on social media or your website or something like that?
Yeah. So everything is pretty much the Physio Fix. On Facebook, on Instagram, thephysiofix.com, if you want to check out our website. And if you're on Instagram, which is where most people find me, in the bio, there's like a link to everything that's you would ever need, pretty much how to schedule with me directly in person, online, how to access my online programs, buy merchandise, and all of my million discount links for all my affiliates. So that's where I am.
Is your new YouTube link on there? I want to check out your, All right. I'm going to check that out. Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Stacy, for visiting you, with us. It was great to have you on.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
That was our interview with Dr. Stacy Morris, the Physio Fix. Thank you so much, Dr. Stacy, for joining us. It was fantastic to learn from you. They can find you at The Physio Fix on Instagram. I believe she already said that, actually. But Britt, where can they find you?
Yeah, sure thing. On Instagram, I am Bralifts. That's BRUH_LIFTS. What about you, Jess?
And you can find me at Jessica_P, JessKah_P. And FemStrong's podcast Instagram handle is FemStrongPod. So FemStrongPod. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Toodle-doo.